the next case.
Anger versus Jacobs and others for Dave Somerville, Appellant Counsel, Michael B. Ware, D. Wayne Ware, Appellee Counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm George Somerville, counsel for Leroy Mandrum Jr. I intend to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Mandrum is an elderly gentleman who agreed to serve without compensation as agent under a power of attorney for his sister-in-law, Bobby Winder. Mrs. Winder was physically disabled, but she was mentally alert, no dispute about that. She just needed someone to carry out her instructions. Mr. Mangrum did just that, and he has been hit with a judgment for over $170,000 as a result. There are three clear reversible errors in this case that should be corrected. The first is requiring Mr. Mangrum to restore $36,000 to Mrs. Winder's estate, $36,000 that he did not control, did not transfer, and did not receive. The second error overlaps with the first, requiring Mr. Mangrum to restore to Mrs. Winder's estate both the $36,000 which Mrs. Mangrum transferred to herself and $116,000 in annuity or life insurance proceeds when neither of those sums otherwise would have gone to the estate, but the order is restore them to the estate. The court did not award judgment to these plaintiffs. It granted the plaintiffs the relief they requested, an order requiring Mr. Mandrum to restore money to the estate.
But now talk about the annuity and life insurance for just a moment. My understanding is that Mr. Mangrum cashed it out at the direction of the decedent now, and then deposited it in a checking account that was owned only by Mrs. Winder. Is that correct?
The checking account was held jointly by Mrs. Winder, Mrs. Mangrum, and Brenda Chavis, one of the plaintiffs.
That was the $116,000?
The $36,000. And it was
well, that's the $36,000. How about the $116,300?
$116,000, there is considerable confusion in the record about the nature of that instrument or interest. The record, it was never introduced into evidence, the document itself. The testimony at times called it an annuity, and times called it a life insurance policy. And the confusion continues on appeal. The appellee's brief at page 1 calls it a policy. At page 3 calls it an annuity.
But the question is, where did the money go?
Where does the money go? If it had remained in that account, the testimony is that the beneficiaries of that account or instrument, whatever its nature was these four plaintiffs individually.
Well, where did it go after he took it out of the account?
It went into a Wells Fargo account held jointly by Mrs. Winder and Mr. Mangrum, and then into Mr. Mangrum's separate account.
And what authority did he have to do that?
I'm sorry, Justin.
What authority did he have to take that money out?
He testified that that was what Mrs. Winder told him to do. That testimony was elicited by plaintiff's counsel. Counsel admonished him that I didn't ask you what she told you, but he did not move to strike it. So that was, and the statute 64.2, I believe it's 1612, requires an agent under a power of attorney to carry out his principal's instructions, and that's what he did.
Well, now, this account at Wells Fargo, was that jointly owned? And or was it an account with survivorship to Mr. Mangrum?
My recollection, Justice Lemons, is it was jointly held, but I will check the record on that and advise you for certain when I stand up for rebuttal.
Well, if it were jointly held, even at her direction. Upon her death, it would all go to Mr. Mangrum, correct?
I'm sorry?
Upon her death, if it was jointly held,
yes,
all of it would go to Mr. Mangrum.
That's correct, yes, Your Honor.
And that's your point. That is that right?
Regarding what money are we talking about?
The $116,000.
No, it went into an account that only his name was on.
See, that's what I thought.
Yeah. The account that Mr. Mangrum put the money in after he received it was in his personal account. Nobody else's name was on that.
He put it into the Wells Fargo account after he cashed out the annuity.
And then he gave it to himself.
And then gave it to himself, yes, sir.
In an account that was solely owned by him.
That
was solely held by him. It was,
yes,
his account.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
So the transfer was from the manner in which it was held would have been distributed to the, if it stayed in the life insurance. The beneficiary clause was to the four stepchildren.
Yes.
When it was transferred, it went into an account that was, I understand, her account.
Yes.
Not joint. And then it was taken out and went into his account, also not joint. Am I right?
I didn't catch the last part of what you said, Justice.
Right. It was in a life insurance annuity kind,
yes,
of instrument.
Whatever.
The beneficiaries were not the estate. It was the four stepchildren. He took the money out, and it went into a joint account between her and Mr. Mangrum. And then it was transferred again to an account that was only Mr. Mangrum. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yes, Justice.
All right, well, if that is correct, it certainly would have gone to the estate of Mrs. Winder if it had remained in her account only, unless there was a survivorship issue in that account, or they were joint owners. Is that correct as well?
Yes.
So to make your point again about this would there was no proof that it would ever go to her estate.
Sorry.
You have said that there's no proof that would have ever gone to her estate. With that scenario, make the argument that it would never have gone to her estate.
Well, I may have overreached just a bit. If it was her sole account, then at that point it would have gone from that account to her estate.
Right.
Yes, I'd have to agree.
All right, well, that was the purpose of my question.
But now, the claim that was made by the complaint was that he improperly transferred it out of the annuity or life insurance, whatever it was. And if these plaintiffs had sued individually, asking for judgment for themselves, they might have had a valid cause of action to recover that money. They didn't. They asked to restore to the estate. And that's the focus of your question. The third assignment
error. Mr. Somerville, couldn't the court take the position that... Couldn't this court take the position that the liability resulted from the later act, which was transferring the money to his own account?
Well, the complaint says the following transactions raise questions, and I'm at page 2 of the appendix. An annuity with a value of $116,336.64 was cashed in by the defendants. The funds were deposited into an account in the name of the defendant. That's the claim. That's what we had to defend.
Right. So the second part of that was it was put into the defendant's,
yes,
account.
Yes.
Right. So the...
And my recollection of the evidence is that it showed an intermediate step, as we've been discussing.
Right, but regardless of that, he could have had liability for transferring it to his own account
if
after the first transfer, because it was supposed to be the money of the beneficiaries.
Yes, if these individuals had sued him for taking money that they would otherwise have been entitled to as individuals, then we would have a very different case. Now, the third error that we've assigned is the award of more than $19,000 in attorney's fees and costs without statutory authority and with no evidence, none to support the amount of the award. The record doesn't even show how much of it was fees and how much of it was cost. There's two issues here. Does Section 64.2-1615 authorize an award of fees that plaintiffs incurred for litigating this action? I submit, and I think the briefs are clear on this, that the statute does not authorize that. The statute permits an award of fees to reimburse the principal, who is Mrs. Winder or her successors, for attorney fees and costs paid on the agent's behalf. The agent was Mr. Mangrum. These fees were not paid on his behalf. But even if the statute did reach this issue, this plaintiff presented no evidence, as I said. This court has held repeatedly that where there is a valid claim for legal fees, a fact finder must determine from the evidence what are reasonable fees under the facts and circumstances of the particular case. That's the Holmes case cited in the plaintiff's brief, Mullins and Taswell cited in a 5:6a letter that I sent to the court. Expert evidence isn't always required, but evidence is. I am aware of no case, and plaintiffs have cited none, where a fee award was based on an unsworn certification of counsel without presentation of any documents, of hours spent, or any other backup. And I will, with the court's permission, reserve the remainder of time for rebuttal.
All right.
Good morning.
Wait just a moment.
I'm sorry, sir.
You may proceed.
Thank you, sir. Good morning, Justices. May it please the court, my name is Mike Ware. I represent the appellees, Brenda.
I'm going to ask you if you'll speak up a little bit.
Yes, sir. I know my esteemed colleague has difficulty, as do I. I represent Brenda Chavis and the siblings in this particular matter. I think the problem we have in this particular case is problematic from the actual burden shifting, and I think my esteemed colleague is probably overlooking that. As you all are aware, the Parfet v. Parfet and the Ayers v. Schaefer case, when you have a power of attorney act such as this, basically shifts the burden. And if you've read the transcripts in this particular case, what Mr. Moore did in this particular case, and as counsel at the trial level, he basically shifted the burden by calling the Mr. Mangrum to testify to these transactions.
May I ask you a preliminary question? I don't want to derail your argument too much, but the four beneficiaries filed this as individual plaintiffs, right? The estate did not file it, and the personal representative of the estate did not file it. Is that right?
No, sir. They filed it individually, and if you look at that particular act, it basically grants that right to anybody that has interest in it. And I think what the procedural aspects of it, to answer your question more succinctly, is that when you are initiating this cause of action, as he referenced in the complaint, basically he says, I've got these smoking guns. I've got these issues with the $36,116 and living in the house. And basically he asked in the court to basically restore those so at some later proceeding you can basically decipher who they belong to.
So the POA Act provides a statutory right of action to individual beneficiaries.
Individuals that may or may not have an action. Basically, if you got a claim because you're a beneficiary, you're an heir or potential heir, then you have standing to bring this cause of action. They brought it individually because they didn't really know what was going on. They were trying to basically sequester the funds that were at issue and maybe discover other funds at issue and ask the court, I think pursuant to the statute, to restore those so that at that point in time, an executor could disperse the funds in accordance to the way they should have been dispersed originally. In this particular case, subsequently, Mr. Mangrum was the executor, but he was replaced. So at that point in time, then guidance could be obtained from the court to basically make a determination. I think that's what the real purpose of the act is. And I think this court, in the Parfet and Ayers case, basically supports what was procedurally happening in this, and that is, if you've got a suspect transaction, you bring your cause of action, and then you shift the burden, because obviously the respondent in this case, Mr. Mangrum, had all the information.
Right, but on the first assignment of error, the $36,000 that the wife transferred to her account, he was acting, Mangrum was acting entirely as a POA, not as a fiduciary beyond that, right?
Well, if you look at the act, and I think counsel and I have a difference of, if you're looking at our briefs, he said we raised for the first time the other requirements of the act. But if you look at paragraph 6 of Joint Appendix 2, the prayer for relief is defended to be ordered to comply with the requirements of the Virginia Uniform Power of Attorney Act. As we set forth in one of our briefs, one of those was to make sure that the assets of the principal were marshaled and taken care of in an appropriate fashion. In the testimony in this particular case, he said, I looked at the bank accounts, I looked at the records, and I knew that my wife had withdrawn this $36,000.
Let me interrupt you one more time, but an agent, an attorney in fact agent under a POA is not a trustee.
He's not a trustee.
But I mean, so are you pushing POA liability too far with assignment of error number one by saying if you become a power of attorney for someone, now you're responsible for their entire estate whether you take action or not? That sounds like a trustee's duty, to be sure. But
I would say in some circumstances, yes. Under these circumstances, I would say no. And the reason I say that is because the testimony in this case is that they were husband and wife, and that they shared in the benefits of that $36,000. Now, I think what the defense, which was the burden put on them to justify this, was to show that this was somehow a basis that they were entitled to it or such as that. Because I don't say that a power of attorney cannot in some manner benefit from his actions, because, I mean, that's accepted in the law. But when you go and put forth the burden to them to come back and justify it, and they don't, because they say we made use of it. I think the court in this particular case said if she'd been a separate person, let's just say she had been somebody not related and took the $36,000 out of an account, it's still the principal's money, but if there's right of survivorship, she had the authority to do that. And it didn't benefit the POA, then I think would have a different
scenario. But doesn't that undermine your argument? As to the initial liability, your argument is he should have, in his POA capacity, kept her from doing it, been monitoring the accounts, and made sure he was informed of it, and when she took the money out, he should have jumped all over it. Now the argument is, well, he can't ever benefit indirectly after the fact, even though he's not liable for her taking it out initially.
Well, no, I think we're talking about two different scenarios. Mm-hmm. I think one scenario is, if he's monitoring the checking account, which in this particular case, the testimony was that she was looking to him to monitor her assets.
But the wife was a joint owner of the account, right?
I agree.
If she takes all of it out, there's no apparent violation there?
Oh, I think there is, because the law in Virginia is that the principal still belongs to the principal. It's still her money. She doesn't lose the control over that. That's basically a mannerism that a lot of banks embrace, because at the end of the, if there's a deceased, then that money flows according to how the deceased wants it to flow.
Well, what happens if Mr. Mangrum tells his wife, you need to put that money back, and she says no, or she says, too late, I've already spent it? Then what? I mean, how is the holder of the power supposed to, what's the duty at that point?
Well, I mean, there could be a lot of ways to enforce that. I mean, he could go to the courts if he needed to, but I'm looking at it from a two-edged sword. Okay, if this court is to say that we can say that as a power of attorney, I could have deposited that money in a joint account with right of survivorship by some third party, and that third party remove it, then the court would be embracing a conspiracy action based upon the technicality that the third party removed it, but I wasn't on the account. I was just the power of attorney, and they had the right to do that. But I could have established that. I do a lot of estate litigation, and you see that a lot, where the POA establishes an account with the POA and the decedent and somebody else with right of survivorship on an account that the principal had the money. I think the court in this case looked to the totality of the facts and said, you know, the $36,001, he probably should have safeguarded it. But you got to remember, the whole purpose of this originally was bring the money back so we can decide where it goes.
And that leads to my second question. Why not put it back in the joint account as opposed to the estate? Because that's where it was to begin with.
Well, I think at that particular juncture, I think the reason being is because in this particular case, the procedural aspects were to use this Power of Attorney Act And that's what the act calls for. I mean, unfortunately, counsel and I both agree that the 64.2.16.15 says the agent that violates this chapter, and I think the court said allowing that was a violation, is to restore the value of the principal's property. So, I mean,
well, what would happen though? I mean, if the wife had not taken the money out and the money had stayed in the account and the decedent dies, then the right of survivorship would kick in, right?
But the same if being one of the largest words in the English language, the same if is what if the decedent had decided to take that money and convey it into another account where she made use of it herself or conveyed it to some other third party. We can't look at the picture of time of when the violation occurred and say that's the determining factors of what the decedent would have done. There was a time period after that the decedent could have changed that, but because of that having been withdrawn, it deprived her of that ability, well, whether she could exercise it or not.
Suppose there were other survivors on that account that could have shared in the survivorship. I mean, I'm not sure I follow the logic of what you just said. Explain it again. Why would not the right answer be we return this to status quo ante? We put it right back in the account where the money should be, but that means that none of these four people get any of it.
Okay, but if you put it back in the account the way it should be after she's deceased and basically go back and say, well, we're going to put it back in the slice of period of time 2 years before her death,
right,
in the joint account with right of survivorship, then we don't know what could have happened from that time period on.
Well, doesn't that mean you lose? You're the plaintiff.
I may lose that $36,000. I'm not saying that, you know, I think what the court was dealing with was basically restoring the property, and the only avenue to restore it at the time that the court made this decision was based upon the act, is to restore what the court had available to it, and that was the estate.
My last question on this subject. Tell me what I'm missing here. The general proposition is the plaintiff says you did something wrong. If you'd not done something wrong, I would have gotten the money. But you can't show that last step. You can arguably show you did something wrong, but you can't say had you not done something wrong, any of the four of these people would have gotten any money. Why doesn't that mean you lose?
I think that's where I'm drawing a distinction. I'm not saying that they brought this to say, if we had brought it to say we would win the money, then there would be a judgment to the moving party individually, the four siblings.
Okay, I see your point, but so I'm going to correct my point then. You say you took the money out. If you hadn't taken the money out, it would have stayed in the account. If it had stayed in the account, it would have gone into her estate. The answer is no, it wouldn't have. It had gone to the survivor on the account, the bank account.
Right.
All right, well, you're not the survivor. You're four plaintiffs are not the survivors.
I believe one of my plaintiffs was a survivor on that account.
Okay, well, the decedent would not get the money. It wouldn't go to her estate under
any scenario. Correct, but in the same terms, it would not have gone to Magnum's wife.
Okay, I get that, but where we're crossing each other is you're the plaintiff. You've got to prove that it would have gone to your four people, because that's who got the judgment.
But I think that's where we're missing the connection here, is by this statute and by the case law that supports this statute, it says because I'm in such a disadvantageous situation and this is a confidential relationship, all I have to do is put forth the fact that these are questionable transactions. The burden then shifts to them to prove it.
But that's on the duty and the breach of the duty. It's
correct.
Not on causation, which is, yeah, and I get the money in the end.
Well,
if
I
should have done it right, I would have gotten this money.
And I'm not sure that's the objective. I think the objective is where the court rules is it comes back into the estate, and then the state marshals the assets and makes a determination of where they would have gone.
I mean, if the life insurance policy had been shown that the money would go to the church, and instead Mr. Mangrum took it in his account, your argument is, oh, too bad, it goes back in the estate and then we'll sort it out later? I mean, is that the argument?
Well, no, because, I mean, as Justice Lemon said, the fact is that the power of attorney acting on her behalf actually removed that money, put it into her account, the decedent's account. If she had died within that week and a half long period, then it would have gone to her estate. So the ifs are the big questions in here. And what happened is then he moves it from there to his name. So what point in time do we draw the line in the sand and say, If it was titled in with the insurance policy had the four moving parties in this case, does it go there? Or do we look at it as it was transferred into an account with her name? What if she deceased then?
Well, what about
the church? The estate?
In his example, what about the church? Suppose that had been the scenario. The annuity is 100% beneficiary of the church. And he took the money out, and he shouldn't have taken it out, and then he took it out and moved it through her account and into his account. Why wouldn't the church be able to file an action and say, look, it certainly doesn't go to the estate and doesn't go to the four beneficiaries of the estate directly under any scenario. It comes all to us because we are the beneficiary of that annuity policy, and the POA was breached when he took the money out of that.
I think the church could come in and make an argument to that effect. I'm not saying that the church could not. I'm just saying that what we've got to look at is how this case unfolded and what happened in this particular case and what the court did. I mean, there's so many scenarios that could be what-ifs in this particular matter because a wrong action, when do you decide what the status is of that money when the wrong action occurred? How is it titled at the time of the action, or how is it titled subsequent, or what could have been titled thereafter? I'm not saying I know the answer to that. All I'm saying is that the court did what it should have done procedurally in this case, and that is restore the assets.
That's an equitable decree. A restoration order is an equitable decree. It usually follows rescission. It's not a money judgment. Why wasn't the right answer a money judgment?
I think the court followed the legislative mandate, and it says restore the value of the principal's property to that which it could have done.
But that, you just read the problem, restore the value.
Correct.
And, well, the value would be restored by a judgment, wouldn't it?
I'm not sure I could answer that question because I think I know my time's out, but I think if I had to redraft this statute, I think maybe I could have done better with it, but I'm stuck with what it says.
And a familiar dilemma.
I'm not going to be able to second guess this.
Well, counsel, I'll tell you, a whole bunch of law professors drafted the statute, but we won't tell them that you said that.
I promise you can tell them.
Bring my feelings.
Thank you very much for your time.
I do have a question, though, if I may, and this refers back to what Mr. Somerville said back. It's interesting because Mr. Mangrum kept on wanting to say during both his direct cross, redirect, and recross, he kept on wanting to say that he was doing what Ms. Winder told him to do. And under the rules of evidence, the trial counsel continually objected and said, no, you can't talk about what she told you to do. She's not here. But at one point on page 20, using your power of attorney, you cashed in the insurance policy and deposited into the account, didn't you? Answer, what she told me to do. And at that point, trial counsel didn't object and say, Judge, strike that. Trial counsel simply said, I didn't ask you what she told you to do. I asked you to use the power of attorney, cashed in the policy, and deposited in its account. In her account, yes. Yes, sir. It goes on. Where is the evidence to dispute that he was doing Ms. Winder's bidding or that at the very least she was aware of what he was doing and agreed with it?
In the form of corroboration?
And in terms of the $116,000, by the way. Not the 30, I'm setting the 36 aside.
I don't think the record is very clear other than the fact there was the attempt to get it in, and I think the judge was ruling that there could not be a corroborating witness, and so I think it was forestalled. I really don't have an answer for you other than that.
But even if that's true, and there was corroboration, the corroboration had to do with she directed him to cash in the annuity. It has nothing to do with him putting it into his own account.
It does not.
All right, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. And first, in response to the question that you raised in my opening argument, the account, the Wells Fargo account, was in the name of Bobby F. Winder, Leroy Mangrum Jr., POA, which I take to mean power of attorney, POD Gregory Winder, which I take to mean payable on death. And that's page 179 of the appendix. So,
When you refer to this, this is the 116 or is this the 36?
That's the $116,000, and you can see that on page 180, the very next page. This is an account statement. I don't have the signature card. I don't think it was ever introduced, but that's the end. So I guess I go back to my first position. It never would have gone to the estate. So an award of judgment directing Mr. Mangrum to restore this money to the estate is simply the wrong relief. It goes to the wrong party.
So what do you think? It should have been given to the plaintiff who was the POD?
Greg Winder is one of the plaintiffs, and had he sued for recovery of the money because it should have stayed in that Wells Fargo account, he may have had a cause of action.
But he did. I mean, it seems like to me that the complaint in this particular instance, they're basically just saying we're four people who are beneficiaries, we want an accounting, and we want the court to direct the money where it should go.
We want money to be restored to the state.
I don't think it says that.
Required to be restored to the state any assets transferred in violation of said act. That's page 2, and it's repeated on page 3. Restore any assets transferred in violation of the act.
May I ask you this about attorney's fees? Your opposing counsel points out you didn't raise it until the motion to reconsider.
Sorry, excuse me for a second. I just wanted the complaint that I have on page 3. It says, wherefore, the plaintiff moves the court to enter an order requiring the defendant, Mangrum, to file a full and complete accounting of his activities as attorney-in-fact for Bobby Winder and to restore any assets transferred in violation of the act and pay plaintiff's attorney's fees and costs. It doesn't say where the assets to be transferred or to whom it is to be restored.
If you look at the bottom of page 2, it does say required to restore to the state estate.
Right, but in the relief, that's one of the things they say in one of their paragraphs, but in the relief they just ask for it to be restored, period.
Well,
okay, but never mind. Go ahead.
I don't read one as expanding the other, but, you know.
Okay.
You filed your motion to reconsider, and as I read the record, the court did not act on it.
Right.
And under Brandon versus Cox, does that foreclose relief on the attorney's fee issue?
Well, I don't see how it does, because the issue was raised both as to the legal issue and to the insufficiency of the evidence at a time when both the plaintiffs and the trial court had an opportunity to correct the deficiency. The trial court could have vacated that portion of the order. That would have corrected the legal error. Plaintiffs could have submitted evidence which would have corrected the evidentiary deficiency. Lambert against CO's condominium, you can prove your fees after the trial. It doesn't have to be part of the prima facie case. Okay. Justice Mims, there's a similar exchange to the one that you were asking counsel about on page 24, and this has to do with the $36,000. You were aware she withdrew $36,000 from that account, weren't you? Yes, after she and Bobby told me, this is Mr. Mangrum testifying. Did you ever take any action to recover? And if you skip down a few lines, no, because I was aware of the fact that this is what Bobby said she wanted done.
But that would only be relevant if we find that he has any responsibility at all for the $36,000.
That's right. That's correct.
Your time has expired. Thank you very much. Call the next case.